Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Smashy Business Show. I am Warit Ahmed.
And I am Abdul Majid.
Happy New Year's. This is our first show back for 2025. What a crazy time. Yeah. I still haven't deeped it, by the way, that it's 2025.
Yeah. It will take some time to change the dates everywhere. Yeah. That is the biggest confusion I have whenever the New Year changes. I'm like, okay, now I have to drive 2025 everywhere. So yeah. It takes a month to settle into that.
Yeah. And can you believe that like one decade ago it was 2015?
Yeah. And 5 years ago it was COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been 5 years to COVID and...
Wow. And we're still all
that
haunted
was
by it.
Some time.
But how are you, Majid? How did you spend your New Year's?
I slept at 10:30, so I didn't see the fireworks. I woke up and I put them on the screen and I was like, okay, let's see what happened. Yeah, because I was not at any venue, so I was like, what will I do?
You know
what? I will watch it on my screen, so I'll be like, I'll watch it in the morning.
you know what? Honestly, I understand it, but I actually saw something so interesting. In Australia, they do something where, like for them, their version of like watching the Burj Khalifa fireworks is actually... watching the fireworks at the beach. And you know what they do for them, for all the families there? They have two fireworks showings. One at 8 p.m. for the families that want to go home and sleep, yeah. And one at 12 p.m. I feel like you would have enjoyed that, Matt.
Yeah, I would have been at the 8 p.m. one.
they do one early for people.
And also, there's so much... the road closures are there. There's whole crowd management protocol, and I don't want to go to any venue with my kid because, again, he's a 4.5-year-old. He'll have his mood. He wants to sleep. He wants to do this. It's so crowded.
I know.
Yeah,
exactly
but
how you
to
feel.
Be honest, the only the intrigue that I have is how much do they spend on it. I need to find out the numbers. Yeah, the fireworks and everything.
A lot of money.
Yeah, I just need to find out. I tried like Googling it, trying to do calculations. Okay, this costs this, that, like trying to find some older numbers or something. But there's never a cost like announced. I just want to
know.
I'll try to find it out.
You know, last year, this reminds me of New Year's last year. Yeah. And I say last year, not this year, because I stayed at home. I stayed at home because I'm sick, but last year I actually went out and I was at Jumeirah, and I remember it was 11 p.m. at night, and me and my best friend decided, okay, we're tired of walking, let's go to a cafe. And we sat at that cafe, and then we're like, we looked at the cafe and we saw that it's like right in front of Burj Khalifa. And then we asked the server, we were like, oh, like, is it all right if we can stay here until it's like New Year's? And Majid, they were charging, I believe, 1,000 dirhams and more for you to take the seat. And me and my best friend just looked at each other and we were like, okay, bye. Because I was completely unaware of this. I did not know that they charged this much. It's crazy.
Nice. But there's like a quick search for the New York numbers. I don't know if they're true, but according to the Irish Sun, just found this one, and it's 45 million dirhams just for the Burj Khalifa fireworks. It's an estimate. We don't know. There's no public figures from the government or anything, so these are not like official numbers. But apparently, from these the Irish Sun article and the estimates that they made through asking the firework experts and everything. Around 45 million, only on the Burj Khalifa one. That's the amazing part. So
that's
we have
how
a lot
of money it takes for them to put it together for people.
And it's always a world record. Like I remember, Rasel Khaimah had this year the biggest drone showing something. So they broke two records. The Dubai ones, I don't remember if they broke any record, but. Obviously, they always try to break a record. Mm. So if I haven't heard about it, and if you know about it, you can tell us. But yeah, 45
but
million
dirhams. It's worth it, though.
Dirhams.
It's worth it.
I think of it as an investment because people travel from countries just to come and see those fireworks.
I was actually going to bring
so
that up.
So they spend on tickets. So the airline gets money. They spend on eating places. So they get money. So somehow the spending comes back into the economy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
and
that's
other,
a good thing.
And other
it's
than
like
that
a
spending point
historic
too,
thing that they do. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It is. Specifically what I was going to say is that I think that them spending this much into making New Year's such a big spectacle for everyone, I think what it also does is that it positions Ihmar at, like, it solidifies their position as, like, in a very important placeholder for, like, Burj Khalifa. Because it's their reputation in the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, Burj Khalifa, it's the tallest building in the world. And the fact that they could put together such a spectacle like this every single year for people, it just solidifies its reputation.
Yeah.
And they need it. They need it every single year. Because in a way, what's happened is that it's actually become a ritual. It's so strange how something so expensive and luxurious has actually become a ritual because they're so dedicated to it. I've lived here since I was a kid, Majid, and let me tell you, ever since I was a kid, these fireworks, they go out without no fail every single year. Every single year. It's not even a joke. And I know this because every single year, my mom, like, we do it in different ways. It's either we'd actually be at Dubai Mall or we'd park our car somewhere and we'd, like, sit on the roof of the car and we'd watch it. So every single year, without fail, that they do this, it just... It's crazy because they made such a luxury seem like something so normal to us Dubai kids. Like, and this is so normal to me.
Just reminded me of something that my brother was in US and one of my friends was in US and they were at Times Square.
Yeah.
So they were at the heart of, like, watching the fireworks and they put up videos. And to be honest, after looking at the Burj Khalifa and all these fireworks that happened, Burj Al Arab, all the big places that do fireworks, it was quite like, it was a very bad show at the New York. So I was like, Dubai and all these places, Abu Dhabi, Ras Al Khaimah now, they've come into the picture as well. They do it so magnanimously that even the Times Square once looked like a dim performance in front of it. So I don't know. It's just, I personally think they're trying to create tourism. So this is one form of tourism as well. Mm. The New Year, New Year's Eve. So people flew in, and I can tell you how people flew in because my wife traveled back from Riyadh on 30th, and she was like, I had to wait 2 hours in the line just to get everything sorted, the visa stamped, the exit and everything. And she's like, I don't know where all these people are coming from and why are they coming? So it was, again, New Year's Eve. Yeah. So, yeah, apparently the Telegraph also tried to contact Imar. They asked them, and Imar refused to tell them how much they spent. So there's a lot of things that happened on the New Year, and there's a lot of financing involved. And
I love how there's an allure behind it.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful allure that's behind it. They won't tell us, and honestly, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, we get to enjoy it without actually realizing how much it's worth.
Yeah.
Because, you know, something I've really deep imagined is when you know the amount of money that is behind something, I don't always think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because when you start deeping it and you start thinking about it and you're like, wow, all in this one
night. I guess it's just the magic trick thing that magicians, they never tell you the secret behind their magic trick. Because then you lose the allure of magic. Like, oh, this happened. As soon as you tell you how they do it, you're like, okay, oh, this was so simple. This was just a sleight of hand and everything.
Imagine it's much more cheaper than they predicted.
Yeah,
maybe. You never know.
But Ras Al Khaimah, they bagged one record, Guinness record, for the longest chain of floating fireworks, which stretched almost 6 kilometers.
Mm.
So this is one of the records that they made. And they also managed to get the longest straight line of pyrotechnic drone displays at 2 kilometers. So these are the two records that they broke. A lot of money goes into it, but it was a very good spectacle and people loved it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's good. And Abu Dhabi had apparently a 53-minute long fireworks display. So that's another record. So there's like a lot of records that happened and there's a lot of economics that goes behind it. But the main idea is that all of this is turned into some kind of a tourism spectacle. And eventually the money flows in through different channels.
I don't just think a tourism spectacle. I also believe, Majid, that this honestly keeps Dubai residents at home for New Year's. Because something that I've noticed is that even the people who actually travel during the winter time, they always make it back in time for New Year's.
Yeah.
They always make it back. And I see it in people's stories, by the way, because everyone's always vlogging where they're traveling. People make it back here for New Year's.
Yeah.
They love New Year's here. And honestly, I can't blame them. I love New Year's here. Like, it's very close to my heart. I can't imagine celebrating it somewhere else.
Yeah, told you, if I was in US and I was at Times Square, if I spent so much money and traveled all the way to US, I would have never been awed by it.
Yeah.
Because the story that I was like, Nah, nothing compared to what we've done
even
here.
Even when I was taking a look at
like
the one in Australia.
Moment of pride as well, right?
Yeah.
You feel certain pride that I'm a resident of this country and this country did this. Oh, so great. And you guys, Times Square. Nothing compared to what we did.
No, you know, even when I was watching the one in Australia, it's like, it was such a like lame beach. Yeah. The beach was dark. It was kind of scary. A bunch of people were there, claustrophobic. Yeah. I was like, I'm okay. Good. That's
ours
not
is
for
better.
Me. But going back to our main topics for today, we have something really, really interesting for you guys. So Abu Dhabi's Mubadala Investment Company has actually surpassed Saudi Arabia's public investment fund as the world's most active sovereign wealth fund in 2024. Now, Mubadala actually spent $29.2 billion in 2024, up from $17.5 billion in 2023. So we can definitely see that from 2023, they increased a lot.
Yeah.
Now, Saudi Arabia's public investment fund actually reduced its spending by 37%, dropping to $19.9 billion from a whopping $31.6 billion in 2023. Now, the Gulf region's sovereign wealth funds, including those from Abu Dhabi, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, overall have actually invested a record $82 billion in 2024. Now, this is so interesting because here what we're seeing is that Abu Dhabi, it's beating Saudi Arabia in something.
And Abu Dhabi, we already know this would have happened. It was kind of coming, but I never knew that Mubadala was so big because I know they're like around $500 billion with assets under management. But I thought ADIA would be the biggest because they're the biggest sovereign wealth one with nearly $1 trillion in assets. But this shows that Abu Dhabi is not going back on anything. They're not scaling back on anything. They are just going to invest each and every day billions and billions of dollars.
And just this year, they were actually ranked as the richest city in the world.
So Abu Dhabi, I think what I always feel about Abu Dhabi is like there's luxury attached to it. If you compare it with Dubai, not any place else right now. If you compare it with Dubai, Abu Dhabi is more exclusive. More
of a mysterious allure. There.
Yeah, there's something about Abu Dhabi that you feel as soon as you enter the city. You don't feel it in Dubai. The Dubai feel is quick, fast paced.
Yeah.
Everything is happening. You just need to find where you want to go.
In Abu Dhabi,
you enter Abu Dhabi and you're like, what do I select? What exclusive or what luxury experience do I want to experience?
Even its people.
Its people are
very private there.
Yeah.
I always have this conversation with my Emirati friends and they always tell me that Dhabi people are very different than the people in Dubai.
Yeah, in Dubai, you will see like a lot of Emiratis and a lot of locals roaming about at the events or doing something at a cafe. In Abu Dhabi, I've never seen that. I lived there for 4 months. It was like hardly I ever saw someone at some place. But then my wife told me that these are some of the cafes which are very well known, that Emiratis frequent them a lot. They love the place or some of them are local businesses.
Yeah.
So they always try to like go to their local business places.
They do. I actually went somewhere. It's called Turtle Cove.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting, it's that the owner of Turtle Cove, they actually have she basically has two cafes, one called The Grove and one called Turtle Cove.
Oh.
They serve the same menu, Majid. The same menu. And I asked, I was like, wait, so what's the point of this? And then I remember my best friend told me it's because of the fact that Turtle Cove, it's marketed towards more of a, like a, like an ocean location, somewhere where there's water. That's why it's called Turtle Cove.
Yeah.
The Grove, it's more towards the city. And the branding, it's so interesting. It's so interesting to me that she rebranded them so they can fit different contexts of the city. I think like Turtle Cove, it's more for Saadiyat. I found that out, I was like, ooh, okay, I see.
Was there a price difference?
No, same price, same product, same everything. I completely didn't understand the rebrand. I was like, why?
Maybe.
Why would you do that? But it actually fit like the residents. For people there, they understood it that way.
Because some of the places that you go to, Barsha, etc., there's this one place, Wakha Afghani. It's very famous for Afghani food, and the food is actually really great. They have a JBR branch. They have the same menu, but different prices. So in JBR, what I eat is usually a platter of like rice and all that stuff, and it's around 160-ish in Barsha. It's good for three or four people. But the JBR branch, same thing is for 300. because it's just the environment is different. You're at JBR. So I was like, maybe for this, they changed like the prices. But yeah, it's a good marketing tactic. Oh, at JBR, yeah. Same food, same everything, different price because experience is different. And in Barsha, like the oldest branch, then like the first branch, we'll give you at a cheaper price, but obviously you won't get the same environment. It's just tables and everything, and you overlook a road. So good strategy for them. But overall, sovereign wealth funds collectively managed $13 trillion in 2024. That's one of the important numbers that we saw. And with they invested $136.1 billion globally, all the sovereign wealth funds. So just imagine 136 and 20 was done by Mubadala itself. So that's wow. That shows you it's a very big number. It's nearly 20%, actually 15% of the total thing. So that's how big it was.
And when we take a look at this number, it's very interesting because what we're seeing is that the UAE, you know, through the tunnel of Mubadala, through Abu Dhabi, they're expanding their footprint.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that these investments are here and they're here globally. You know, just very recently, we were telling you guys about how the UAE is actually the top investor in Africa.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing how they're specifically expanding their footprint everywhere.
Yeah.
And I find that so interesting. Yeah. And you know, just off topic, Majid, I just read something very recently that the UAE, just alone in 2024, actually recorded $6 billion in transactions in real estate.
Nice.
And I found that to be completely insane. And the reason why I mention this specifically is because, you know, just recently I went to the property show for Benghazi.
Yeah.
I'm starting to realize how important real estate is to this country. It is so crazy. It really is crazy. And you think to yourself that, you know, if I become a broker, I won't make it. Because there's so many of them. There is. But honestly, I do think you could make it.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to be a broker, I definitely think you could make it. Because the market is so big. Yeah. And it just keeps on getting bigger.
Yeah. We did a story and it did really well. I don't know. I guess we have a lot of followers on Instagram who are real estate agents. And then we got a lot of more followers, real estate agents. The story that Dubai did, wait, let me find it. Oh, yeah. In 2024, AED $517 billion.
Mm.
570. That's like half a trillion of sales happened in Dubai only. And then Dubai property is apparently going to grow 10 to 15% in 2025 as well. So I posted it on the story and I was like, is it a bubble or do you think it's growth? And a lot of people said it's growth. So it shows that the main thing that I think, my personal opinion, not an expert opinion, but a personal opinion, that there is demand for property.
Of course.
Is why it's growing. Because in a lot of global real estate markets, which are big, New York, China, even China is facing a bad time in property, but still it's a big market because people need office spaces to work and this and that. So even the biggest
England.
Property markets, the demand is not there because no one wants to move there. So the people who are already there, they're investing in real estate as an asset. In Dubai, people actually need it because people are moving in, so they need
expensive.
Either they need to rent a place or buy a place to live.
Yeah.
So that is why there is demand and people are moving in flocks. The last year, the biggest number that I remember was 6,700 millionaires moving. That was last year that 6,700 millionaires will move to Dubai by 2028. So that was the highlight of the year. But 6,700 millionaires, I don't remember if it was you or Hind when we interviewed Kabir Joshi. He's the head of...
Probably Hind.
Hind. So he gave us a very good number, and I remember it again, last year's numbers. That he said that all these millionaires, when they come here, obviously they'll set up businesses. So they'll bring in one, two, three, four people from outside. Those people will need houses.
Of course, these people
will need houses.
Imagine, you know, I know this, and it's not even an opinion that you're actually giving.
Yeah.
It's confirmed because my sister works in real estate.
Oh.
She works for Keepers, and something that is constantly happening is that you know, she has so many family members and cousins coming to her and telling her, hey, my American friend moved to Dubai. He's trying to find a fully furnished apartment to buy, not to rent, but to buy. And it's a lot of friends that we hear of, Americans, Asians, they fully just want a furnished apartment. Yeah. And the amount of times that I've heard this is crazy. But, you know, you mentioned something interesting that I just want to point out. You said that they're... you know, places like New York and, you know, England, they have a growing real estate market. A long time ago, we did this piece where it was so interesting because it actually showed that Saudi Arabian businessmen are investing into real estate in England more than in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And I remember when I was doing that piece back then, it was so interesting to me because I was like, why would you do that? You know, why would you invest into the real estate in England? And I remember the conclusion that I came to was because of the fact that Saudi Arabia's real estate market wasn't as booming as England. But now what we're seeing, it's completely different. Have you seen the Red Sea? I was so surprised, Majid.
Yeah, I
was truly very surprised. Yeah. I did not know that they had something like this.
I know Red Sea is a very big development that they're doing. Some of it is part of NEOM, some of it is separate development. But mainly, that's what Saudi is trying to get into, luxury real estate. And it's not just luxury real estate in terms of homes and offices, luxury real estate in terms of hotels. They're opening luxury hotels, luxury experiences.
I honestly thought it was the Maldives for a second. I really thought it was the Maldives. When I was like, this is Saudi Arabia, I was like, this is crazy. Yeah. Like, they are topping everything. Yeah. They're really getting there.
But Saudi's main idea, to be honest, we should give credit to Saudi Arabia in this story as well, Mubadala story, because obviously Mubadala ramped up their spending. They went up to 20 billion.
Yeah.
But Saudi, they went down because of two reasons. One, they've stopped spending outside, and we saw that FIIA, governor of PIF, said that Public Investment Fund, the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Saudi Arabia, clearly said that now we're looking inwards. That is why their deployment of capital outside of the country has decreased. Because now they're investing inside. So even with the real estate or any startup scene or any business scene, they want to look back because they've made their investments outside. The return is coming from them. And they're using that money to fuel their own local growth. So it's not like PIF was performing badly. They did good, but now their focus is mainly inside. So that is why they reduced their spending from 37 something billion, which Bert told you, to 19 something
and
that they've come down to.
So that's good. I think that the best investment that any possible country can make is
on
its own
people.
No, truly, it's in itself. Because when you invest in your people, the results are absolutely outstanding. Yeah. And this is something that my family specifically, we always point out about the UAE because of the fact that, you know, I grew up here and I have a lot of Emirati friends. Growing up, Majid, I saw the benefits that they specifically received because of simply being from this country. And that was something, it was such a benign concept to me because of the fact that, you know, in my country, I didn't actually get any, you know, I didn't get any privileges for actually being from there. But, you know, what we're seeing specifically in the Gulf region, and you see this in all of them, in Bahrain, in Qatar, in Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, they care about their people and they give them benefits.
Even having a resident visa, like we're not citizens, like we don't have the passport, we just have a resident visa, even that gives you so much travel easiness. Because if you have a UAE resident visa, you can apply on my passport, I can apply to a lot of countries. Which, if I were in Pakistan, I would have to go through a whole two-month procedure. But just having the UAE residency, I can just fill out a form online and go there.
And even if you actually have the golden visa. I remember when I used to work as a sales associate for Lush, and because I have a golden visa.
Yeah.
And what essentially happened is they told me that there might be a chance you might not be allowed to work here.
Yeah.
Because you're, and I was like, excuse me, no, because the entire thing, if you think about it, it's ironic. Yeah. I have the golden visa, but I still need to work. But they said that when you have it, companies are actually obliged to treat you better.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, not obliged, to be honest, but they look at the golden visa and they're like, okay, they got it. Because of some reason. So we can't be like, we can't treat them like other ones. We may have to give them 1% extra special treatment. My wife has it, but she has it from Abu Dhabi in the journalist category. And what I've seen, to be honest, she doesn't get any benefit because of it.
Oh.
To be honest, no job preferences like everyone is. So it's to be honest, it's quite the right thing to do, equality is there. They don't look at your visa status. They look at your merit. If you are good on merit, they'll give you a job, regardless of the visa process.
I think you do get benefits for it, because I have a friend.
The benefit is that for 10 years, she doesn't have to care about the visa. But yeah. But apart from that, I've never seen her get any special treatment because of it. Like, if she would have, she would have told me. But she never got any. Maybe she didn't try hard enough. But I guess it will help. It depends.
Because, like, for example, I know a family friend. They got it from getting really high grades.
Oh, nice.
So they received the golden visa.
Yeah.
So what actually happened is, after she graduated and she entered into the job market, it was easier for her to get jobs because she had the golden visa.
Yeah, that part I agree with, because some people, they don't want to give you a visa because they don't want to get with the visa, pay the visa cost. So that way it helps you in getting jobs because you have your own visa. They'll just apply for the work permit and you can work there. So visa fees is that's one thing that they save on.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's not that much, to be honest.
And now for our second topic of the day, it's about NEOM, our favorite project, which is worth $1.3 trillion in Saudi Arabia. Now, we know that very recently, they had this entire situation where their CEO stepped down. And, it made a lot of people question whether the NEOM project is going to be completed. It is going to be completed for sure, but something else has happened. Essentially, the German air taxi developer Volocopter has filed for insolvency. Essentially, insolvency is they are unable to pay their debts.
Yeah.
Is what it is, citing difficulties for securing fresh funding. Now, backed by Saudi Arabia's $500 billion NEOM Giga project, Volocopter was set to actually power urban air mobility across NEOM's flagship developments like The Line, Oxagon, and Trojena. So from what we're seeing here, it's that Volocopter, it's necessary for NEOM.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're announcing insolvency, especially at a time like this where the project is still being built, it's not exactly the best news. Now,
the problem is funding, mainly. But the only good thing is that they're trying to restructure, maybe cut their costs and get it done by 2025 at least.
And so, Volocopter is actually supported by major players like Mercedes-Benz, Intel, and we can see that they're supported by very major players, but them announcing insolvency,
that
is a little bit scary.
So it's a very topsy-turvy thing that's happening with NEOM. One day we get something like, oh, the CEO is changing, he wasn't aligning with the goals, so we have put someone in place who is already there. The guy who came in place of Nadmi, he handled 10, 15 years, he was with NEOM. He was handling the real estate side of NEOM. He was made as the acting CEO. They still haven't announced that if he is going to be a full-time one or maybe if they get a new CEO. But after that, there was a Spanish company which works on the NEOM project, and they have nearly 20% of the whole project under them. They came back and they're like, okay, there's no payment problems. Everything is on time. So bad news, good news. Now, this is not bad news per se, because this doesn't directly reflect the construction of NEOM, but this company...
I think it's expected, Majid, because the project, it's so big. As I said, it's worth $1.3 trillion. You know, that's what they require.
Yeah.
And especially with the fact that NEOM, if you guys heard, they have different areas.
Yeah.
It has so many different areas, like, for example, Trojena and Oxagon and The Line. So into this project, of course, there's going to be setbacks.
Yeah.
You know, that's completely expected.
See, the only thing that I always say is whenever you're trying for something so, so big, so, historic that no one has ever heard about it, there will always be setbacks, because sometimes the technology doesn't catch up. Sometimes the manpower, the expertise of the people who are building it, that doesn't catch up. So it's a good thing that the new year has started, and it's a good thing that now the plans are, everything is about 2025. Everyone will put 2024 in hindsight and just take the lessons and try to make 2025 a good year. The only thing that I can say is NEOM is going to become a reality, 100%. That I can say with the surety, because the way that they've, maybe on a smaller scale, maybe on whatever scale, but it will become a reality. That's the main thing about NEOM.
I agree that it will become a reality, but I honestly agree that it will become a reality because they're too far in.
Yeah.
That's truly why I believe it's going to happen. It's going to happen because they've already put so much money into it. They're not going to back out now.
After just 8 days in Saudi, in 33 years, I've only spent 8 days in Saudi, but I've realized that very determined people, if they think about something, they do it. This whole Middle East region, they're very determined on everything. Even you look at the clashes that are happening, all the problems that are happening in Middle East, the people are so determined. Like the Syrian case, they fought for 13 years and finally they got rid of Bashar al-Assad. The Palestinian problem, they're so adamant, they're so hardcore, these people, that you can't really put anything away from them. You'll be like, no, if they have thought of doing it, they will do it. Saudis are like that similarly. It's just the will that this region, the people in this region have.
So much. It has. And I think for me, seeing this changed, it's so beautiful, because I remember there was a time, Majid, where, you know, when I used to watch football games with my dad, only watch it with my dad because I don't like football, but he likes it, so I'll join in. But point is, I remember when I used to watch football games and say it was like a Saudi team or it was, I'm not sure, but if say like the audience was a lot of Saudi Arabian people, there was this case where a lot of the girls who were attending the event, when the camera would flash at them, they'd like raise something up and cover themselves. Of course, because we know what the situation was like for women. So
but now
it's so different. It's like now it's so different. They didn't just evolve in terms of gender roles themselves, but they evolved in terms of their economy.
Yeah.
Their economy, it's crazy. They really are diversifying. And they're not just, you know, diversifying to create like a, you know, a well-operating free market. They're diversifying to actually have the very best. Oh. Because the Red Sea, that does not look like anything I've seen in another country.
And in Saudi also.
It looks very... I know.
Yeah. You think of Saudi as a desert or just buildings.
Exactly.
Or maybe the religious whole area.
Yeah.
The idea, the picture that you get in Saudi Arabia, as soon as you think about it, is Makkah, Medina, Jeddah Tower, the tower in Riyadh. Like, there's like 5, 6 or maximum 10
not
pictures
anymore.
That quickly come to your mind. But now, every day, you are like, okay, oh, something new is happening. Oh, something new is coming up. So they're actually changing the mental image of people about Saudi Arabia. Mm. So, yeah, eVTOL is electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. Basically, the air taxi that we're seeing in Dubai is the same. So Saudi is trying to get maybe this company get back. Worth is a financial expert, so she can tell us better if insolvency is reversible, if they can restructure, cut their costs, and try and maybe get a new fresh funding from someone, and that can help them like pay off their debt and restart. But the idea is that they're trying to finish the product that they promised, the flying air taxi. So if they can do that and then go bankrupt or go into solvency, maybe then it's not a problem.
Look, I definitely think it's reversible, but once you have to announce something like that, do you honestly think that your investors would trust
you?
Exactly.
They will not.
Exactly. Like the major players that they have with them, are they still going to have them with them?
Probably confidence is lost. It's all about trust and confidence at this point.
And finally, for our last topic of the day, ADNOC is planning to inject $54 billion into the UAE's economy over the next 5 years via its in-country value program. Now, what is this program? The program ensures ADNOC spending remains within the UAE, benefiting local suppliers, businesses, and workers. Now, key achievements for ADNOC in 2024 was actually this very big investment into the UAE economy. And ADNOC actually also created 5,500 private sector jobs for UAE nationals in collaboration with the Emirati Talent Competitiveness Council. And they actually also established 16 new manufacturing facilities in the UAE. But other than that, what's also very interesting, which we reported very recently on Smashy Business on Instagram, it's that ADNOC is actually planning to expand with more retail stores. This is something that they're actually trying to do, and it's because of the fact that there has been a drop in oil prices globally, and it's just been recently reported once again by Reuters. And what gas stations like ADNOC are trying to do is that they're trying to make up for the oil cuts by coming up with new revenue streams.
Yeah, and the main idea of in-country value program, what I've seen, I've heard about it over the last year a lot. The idea is to, again, do what Saudi is doing on a national level. ADNOC is also trying to do that on a national level, but through a private, ADNOC is a government-owned entity. So ADNOC is doing that also. They are planning to give people jobs and everything. The last number that I saw over their performance over the last few years, since 2018, they've invested $242 billion. So 2018 to 2024, it's like 6 years. Over 6 years, they've spent already $242 billion. They've added it back into the economy. So it's a good plan that they're planning to do 5 years now. So good plan. That's what we were talking about always, and that this country, the companies, the state-owned companies, the sovereign wealth fund, everything you see is kind of in a circular motion where they, even if they invest outside, whatever the returns are, they're spent on the people. Whatever they earn from the, whatever they sell, oil, gas, tourism, whatever is they're earning, eventually comes back to the people in some form. And this in-country value program is just one part of that. Trying to give people whatever they have earned, make them a part of it.
And you know, just like on this topic of oil, oil is crazy. I know that we're constantly speaking about how countries in the GCC are diversifying, but the oil industry is a lovely industry to be a part of, Majid. You know, growing up, actually, a lot of the family members who I knew who are very wealthy, they actually worked in oil. That was the kind of business that they worked in, and they always did really well. And as a kid, I'd always think to myself, you know what, that's the direction I should be in. That's where. But I'm not interested whatsoever. I'm not interested in engineering. I'm not interested in it. But I just, the wealth in oil, the oil that they have here, I know that we're constantly telling you guys that they're diversifying, but oil is so powerful.
Yeah. The foundation is oil, but they're building something good on it.
Of course. And with that being said, thank you so much for watching today's show. Happy New Year's. Don't forget to put down your New Year's goal for 2025. This is Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production under the Augustus Media Podcast Network. See you tomorrow.